Hello, and thank you for joining us for the sixth episode of our podcast. In this episode, we'll examine a landmark case in the world of criminology, the Bear Brook Murders. Since the case is so complex and spans decades, we've decided to break it into two episodes. Part 2 will be available next week, so make sure you subscribe or follow so you don't miss it. The puzzling and convoluted case that would change the world of criminology started in the fall of 1985. On November 10, 1985, two brothers were hunting in Bear Brook State Park. Bear Brook is a 10,000-acre nature preserve in Allenstown, New Hampshire. It has hiking trails and several swimming and fishing ponds. On November 10th, two brothers had wandered out of the park and ended up on a private lot that neighbored the park. The lot was once home to a store, but the store had burned down a few years ago. On the lot, the brothers came across a 55-gallon drum. One of them kicked it, and the lid came off the barrel. A plastic bag came out of the barrel. In the bag was a human foot. The brothers immediately called the police. The police collected the remains from the barrel. Initially, it was thought it was the remains of just one person, but it turned out to be two females. One was a young girl, possibly between the ages of 5 and 11. She was 4'3" and had light brown or blonde hair. The other remains belonged to a female that was somewhere between the ages of 22 and 33. She had wavy light brown hair, and she was 5'4 to 5'8. It was clear to the medical examiner that they had both died from blunt force trauma to the head. According to the book, Chase Darkness With Me by Billy Jensen, it appeared that the young victim was beaten to death with a brick. What was less clear was how long they had been dead. The medical examiner estimated that they had been dead anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. The police did their best to identify the bodies, but they didn't match any missing persons reports. Also, no one came forward to claim them. In May 1987, 18 months after the remains were found, the remains were interred at a cemetery in Allenstown. The following message was inscribed on the tombstone: "Here lies the mortal remains known only to God of a woman aged 23 to 33 and a girl child aged 8 to 10. Their slain bodies were found on November 10, 1985 in Bear Brook State Park. May their souls find peace in God's loving care." For 15 years, no progress was made on the case. Then in May 2000, the case was reopened. In November 1985, when the bodies were found, the number one song on the Billboard charts was "We Built This City" by Starship. 2 months earlier, the television shows The Golden Girls and MacGyver made their broadcast debuts. The number one movie was the third movie in the Death Wish franchise, starring Charles Bronson. When the case was reopened in May 2000, 15 years later, Gladiator, starring Russell Crowe, was number one at the box office. The top song on the Billboard charts was "Maria Maria" by Santana, featuring the product G&B. That month, the reality shows Survivor and Big Brother debuted. Needless to say, it was a much different time. On May 9, 2000, a detective went out to the lot where the bodies were found. About 300 feet from where the barrel was found, he noticed several other 55-gallon barrels. He went up to them and moved some around. One of them felt like something was inside of it. He managed to shine a flashlight into an opening, and he saw some plastic and something white. So he called his superiors. It turned out that the detective had found the remains of two more people. Specifically, it was two young girls. The elder of the two girls was somewhere between the ages of 2 and 4. She had an overbite. She had wavy brown hair that was darker than the others, and she was about 3'8". The other girl was a toddler between the ages of 1 and 3. She was about 2 feet to 2.5 feet tall. She had light, wavy hair and a gap between her front teeth. When the detective found the second barrel, he wasn't sure how long the barrel had been there. Was it there when the first barrel was discovered and was just missed by the original investigators? Or was it dumped there in the years after the first barrel was found? The medical examiner believed that all four were killed at the same time. Also, the two girls died the same way as the other two females. They had died from blunt force trauma to the head. So the police assumed that the barrel had been there 15 years earlier and it was missed by the investigators. The discovery of the two bodies in the second barrel gave new life to the investigation. Previous investigators had been looking for two females who were possibly related. But then they realized that they should have been looking for reports of 4 missing females, 1 adult and 3 children. The police thought it was most likely a mother and her daughters. Surely someone, like a family member, a teacher, a co-worker, a neighbor, would have reported them missing. But the police didn't find a single record or report that helped them identify the 4 bodies. The case was baffling to the police. How could a woman and 3 children go missing and no one noticed? So once again, the case became cold. 13 long years went by. In February 2013, the police released some information regarding the DNA results. It turned out that only 3 of the females were related. Specifically, the adult female was related to the oldest and the youngest child. The middle child had no familial DNA connection to the other 3. A few months later, it was revealed that the adult female was maternally related to the oldest and the youngest child. That means the children are related to her through the mother. So the police thought that she was the mother of the 2 children. But she could have also been the aunt of the children. But the police still had no clue who they were or how the middle child was connected to them. They speculated that she was a stepsister to the girls and a stepdaughter to the woman, or she was adopted. But they had no way to prove this theory, and it remained just that, a theory. In June 2013, facial reconstructions of the 4 victims were released. But once again, it failed to generate any useful tips. November 10, 2015, was the 30th anniversary of the discovery of the first set of bodies. It had been 15 years since the second set of bodies had been found. A lot had changed in the 3 decades since the first bodies were found. In 1985, the format war between Betamax and VHS was still raging. In 2000, Netflix was just a DVD rental company. In the fall of 2015, Netflix was the biggest streaming service in the world. They had 3 major hits released that autumn: Master of None, Jessica Jones, which is based on the Marvel comic book character, and the true crime phenomenon, Making a Murderer. Big Brother and Survivor, which debuted in 2000, were still on the air. The number one movie on the 30th anniversary of the bodies being found was Spectre, the 24th movie in the James Bond series. In 1985, A View to Kill was released, and it was the 14th movie in the James Bond series. In the 3 decades since the bodies were found, 4 different actors have portrayed James Bond. The top song in November 2015 was Hello by Adele. Despite all the changes in the world, investigators were not much closer to identifying any of the females. Around the 30th anniversary, the police did make some more test results public. They were the results of radioisotope testing. The testing was conducted to try to narrow down where the 4 females lived. Radioisotope testing is more commonly used in archaeology and geology. The science behind it is a bit complicated, so we're going to try our best to explain it simply and accurately. First, it's essential to know what exactly an isotope is. To understand that, you need to know how atoms work. Atoms are the building blocks of life. A nucleus is at the center of an atom. A nucleus is made up of 2 different kinds of particles, protons and neutrons. Inside the atom, the nucleus is surrounded by electrons. In neutral atoms, there are an equal number of protons and electrons. Next, you need to know about elements. Elements are substances that cannot be broken down any further, like oxygen or gold. Every element is made up of atoms. How atoms differ from each other to make up each element is the number of protons in them. The atoms in oxygen have 8 protons, and the atoms in gold have 79 protons. Isotopes have the same number of protons and electrons as the atom, but they have different neutrons. So chemically, isotopes and atoms are the same, but they have different atomic masses because they have different numbers of neutrons. For example, 1 type of atom makes up oxygen, but there are 3 main isotopes of oxygen: oxygen-16, oxygen-17, and oxygen-18. Oxygen-16 has 8 neutrons, oxygen-17 has 9 neutrons, and oxygen-18 has 10 neutrons. If you didn't understand all that, that is not a problem. What is essential to understand is that different areas of the world have different types of isotopes. In the podcast Bear Brook from New Hampshire Public Radio, a geologist named George Kamenoff gives an example using oxygen. With 10 neutrons, oxygen-18 is the heaviest type of oxygen isotope. Areas near a coast have more oxygen-18 isotopes than places that are more inland. When rain clouds come off the ocean, oxygen-18 is the first to fall from the rain clouds. Different types of isotopes enter the human body, and they are stored in bones and hair. So someone living on the coast would have more oxygen-18 isotopes in their bones than someone living in the prairies. Radioisotope testing determines what isotopes are in the bones and hairs. The radioisotope testing revealed several things about the bodies in the barrels. For most of their lives, the 3 related victims lived in the same area. They could have been the West, the Midwest, or West Virginia to New England. The middle child had isotopes that indicated that she lived most of her life further north than the others. She most likely lived in the Midwest, upstate New York, or northern Maine. Isotope testing on hair can reveal where someone was living recently. The tests on the hair revealed that all 4 victims lived in the same area for 2 weeks to 3 months before they were killed. That area was most likely New England. New Hampshire, where the bodies were found, is one of the 6 states that make up New England. That means for at least a few weeks, they lived close to where their bodies were found. So it's not likely that they were killed elsewhere, then transported and dumped in the lot outside of Bear Brook State Park. While the radioisotope testing helped narrow down where the victims lived, it did not lead to their identity. In July 2016, the Allentown's investigators were contacted by a detective named Peter Headley, who with the Sheriff's Department in San Bernardino, California. Detective Headley had a possible lead for them regarding the Bear Brook investigation. He thought that the adult victim might be a woman named Denise Bowden. Denise had lived in Manchester, New Hampshire, which is about 15 miles from Allenstown. Denise was 23 years old when she was last seen at Thanksgiving 1981. Denise had never been officially reported missing. Denise's family never really explained why they didn't report her missing. One investigator said that the family's relationship with Denise was complicated. The investigators were intrigued by Headley's call for several reasons. Denise was 23 when she went missing, and the adult Jane Doe was between the ages of 23 and 33. Also, the barrel containing the adult's body was found in November 1985, 4 years after Denise was last seen alive. This is close to the theorized timeline as to when the four were killed. So Denise Bowden's DNA was compared to the DNA of the adult female. It was not a match. In fact, Denise had no familial DNA connections to any of the females. Then Detective Headley suggested comparing the female's DNA to a man who was Denise's boyfriend at the time she went missing, Bob Evans. The investigators compared Evans' DNA to the DNA of the victims. The results shocked them. 31 years after the first two bodies were found, the police had their first big break. Bob Evans was the father of the middle child. The investigators needed to know who exactly was Bob Evans. Unraveling the identity of Bob Evans started 15 years earlier, in September 2002, in Richmond, California. The police in Richmond brought a man named Larry Vanner into the police station for an interview. Vanner's wife, 44-year-old Unsun June, had not been seen in 4 months. June was a chemist who had worked for several biotech companies. But her real passion was art and making pottery. On July 31st, 2002, June would have turned 45, and no one had seen or heard from her. June's friends would ask Vanner where she was, and he would give them a bunch of different answers. One of June's friends was the person who reported her missing in September 2002. Vanner voluntarily gave his fingerprints. When the police ran his fingerprints in the system, they found out several surprising things about him. First, Larry Vanner wasn't his real name. According to the criminal record connected to his fingerprints, he was Curtis Mayo Kimball. Since Curtis Kimball was his name in the criminal justice system, they proceed with the case using that name. In March 1989, Kimball was convicted of child abandonment in California, and he was sentenced to 3 years of prison. He served 18 months, and then he was paroled. On the day he was paroled, he fled town to parts unknown. So when Larry Vanner / Curtis Kimball was questioned in September 2002, he was still considered to be on parole. This allowed the police to search his home without a warrant. The home he had shared with Unsun June had an unfinished basement crawl space with a dirt floor. In the basement was a large mound of kitty litter that was about 3 feet high. A forensic team was called in, and they started to sift through the cat litter. They found a dismembered, mummified human foot that was still wearing a rubber flip-flop. Hidden in the pile, the forensic team found the dismembered body of 44-year-old Unsun June. The medical examiner determined she had died from blunt force trauma. In the crawl space, the forensic team found blood splatter. It's believed that June was beaten to death in the basement and then she was dismembered. Her body parts were then buried in the pile of cat litter. Curtis Kimball was subsequently charged with Eun Sung Jun's murder. He went to trial in June 2003. In most criminal cases, the defendant pleads guilty before the trial, or they go to trial and await the outcome. Kimball did neither. Against the advice of his lawyer, on the second day of his trial, he pleaded guilty. He was sentenced to 15 years to life. On the Bear Brook podcast, Detective Roxanne Grunheim, who worked on Eun Sung Jun's case, thought she knew why Kimball pleaded guilty. She thought he was trying to hide something. On the first day of the trial, Grunheim told the district attorney that she was looking into Kimball's past. When she said this, Kimball was in earshot. Grunheim believed that Kimball thought by pleading guilty, he would stop Grunheim from investigating him. If that is what he thought, he was dead wrong. Grunheim felt even more confident that he was hiding something. Detective Grunheim discovered Kimball was first arrested in 1985. In May 1985, Kimball was driving with a young girl in his vehicle in Cypress, California. They were involved in a collision. Kimball was subsequently charged with driving under the influence and endangering the welfare of a child. He was released pending his trial, but he never appeared to stand trial. For skipping out on his trial, he became a fugitive. But the authorities had no idea where he went. Over a year later, in the summer of 1986, a couple brought a 5-year-old girl to the sheriff's office in San Bernardino County, California. They explained they had been living in a trailer park in the Holiday Host RV Park in Scotts Valley, California. Also living in the park was a girl named Lisa and her father, Gordon Jensen. Lisa and Jensen lived in a small camper on the back of a pickup truck. The couple said that they often looked after Lisa when Jensen was busy. Over the months, they became concerned for the girl. They noticed she kept getting thinner and she didn't have any toys. The couple mentioned to Jensen that their daughter and her husband were thinking of adopting a child. Jensen said that they could take Lisa for a 3-week trial adoption. So the couple dropped Lisa off with her daughter and son-in-law. Soon afterward, Lisa started showing signs that she had been sexually abused. The couple and their daughter and son-in-law realized it was probably best to legally adopt Lisa as soon as possible. But when they went to get Gordon Jensen to sign the adoption papers, they discovered he had vanished. The couple had no idea where he went. The police went to the trailer park and they found Jensen's fingerprints. Based on the fingerprints, it was determined that Gordon Jensen was really Curtis Kimball, who was a wanted fugitive for skipping out on trial, for driving under the influence, and endangering the welfare of a child. Lisa was put into foster care and she was eventually adopted by a family who resided on the West Coast. The police had no idea where Curtis Kimball / Gordon Jensen went after the trailer park. For abandoning Lisa, an arrest warrant was issued. But it would be years before Curtis Kimball was located. In part 2, we'll catch up with Curtis Kimball and more of his secrets will be revealed. But that's all for today's episode. However, before we sign off, we want to give a quick summary of what we've covered already. On November 10, 1985, the remains of 2 females, one adult between the ages of 22 and 33, and a younger female between the ages of 5 and 11, were found in a barrel in a lot outside Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, New Hampshire. 15 years later, another barrel was found a short distance away. It contained the remains of 2 young girls, one who was between the ages of 2 and 4, and the other was a toddler, possibly 1 or 2 years old. They had all died from blunt force trauma to the head. It was later determined that the adult, the oldest, and the youngest child were related. It is believed that she was the mother of the two children. The middle child was not related to the other victims. Then in October 2016, investigators discovered that the middle child's father was a man who went by the name Bob Evans. Evans' history is convoluted and he used many different aliases, and we'll discuss that in our next episode. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Our producer and sound designer is Danelle Cloutier. You can find a link to her Instagram in the description box. The Bear Brook podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio was a major source for this episode. It's an excellent series, and you should check it out for yourself, but we recommend waiting until you hear part 2 of our coverage of the case. If you just discovered our podcast, check us out on YouTube at youtube.com/criminallylisted. We have over 250 videos featuring some of the most bizarre true crime stories you'll ever encounter. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Well, that's all for today. Thank you again for listening.